morning. This week, the New York Times printed an article that caught my attention. It was about the rivalry between sports teams and how that happens. So, heads up, this is the first time ever that I have referenced sports in preaching. It is likely to be the last time, but it really interested me. I'm interested in this because I teach about conflict, and the sports rivalry as an example of enemy identity forming and enemy making was really interesting to me. Now, I am not an athlete, and I'm also not a very good sports fan. My interest in sports goes as far as me knowing the players. So basically, if I raised you or I teach you, I'm interested in your sport, marginally. I'm interested more in you, and I will come to see your sport because it is important to you. And I've been this way my whole life. I went to a high school in Cleveland that had a rivalry with the high school across town. Now, mind you, again, I'm not an athlete and marginally interested in sports, but I reveled in my identity as a John F. Kennedy Eagle, and the school across town were the John Adams Raiders, which, by the way, South Bend, John Adams is the Eagles, and it's so wrong. Every time I drive by it, it's like, no, y'all are not the Eagles, you are Raiders. So on the few occasions in high school that I went to football games, it was basically to socialize and hang out with my friends. I didn't care about football, not one bit, thank you. But did I know that the John Adams Raiders were my enemies? I sure did. And this wasn't even something that I needed to think through very carefully. I just knew that they were bad and we were good simply because of the schools we went to and the relative superiority of our school colors and school mascot, which, by the way, was a very muscular eagle carrying a football, by the way. Anyway, back to the New York Times article that is reporting on this study. They questioned fans of college football teams as to who their rivals were to see if the rivals actually were rivals of each other. And there were some takeaways from the study that were really interesting to me. One, fans hold grudges and remember defining moments for a long time. As the parent of a soccer player, I can attest to the fact that they can recite chapter and verse what happened in a game 10 years ago and how wrong it was. So that made sense to me. Another takeaway was that rivalries go back many years. You don't even have to know what the defining moment was. You just need to know that the ones who came before you knew what it was, and they hold a grudge, and therefore, since you're part of them, you hold that grudge as well. Rivalries can be unbalanced. One team may consider another team their biggest rival, while the other team doesn't even think about them very much at all. So there's not always a reciprocal dislike, but the rivals are often very similar to one another. And then at the very end of the article, a couple of things. Anyone who spends time with what they are calling in the article a super fan will see how dislike of a rival can drive the fandom, and that these passions are rooted deeply, and that fans are more likely to outwardly display their connection to a team after a win. That sense of belonging is ramped up because, yes, we did it. Yes, and we are part of each other. And people use more of a we and us when describing the team following a win. And the thing that's fascinating to me, and we see this in real life, is that these are the fans. These are not the players. These are the fans that are living into that identity of the team. There's something really, really important about being part of a we and part of an us. And sometimes it works very, very well. It's a good thing, right, to have this sense of belonging. But sometimes it works to divide us from one another. I am part of this group, you are part of that group, therefore we have fundamental differences that can't be bridged, so why would we even bother to talk to one another? And we get that from somewhere, right? Even though we all think and know that we are very unique and independent and amazing in our uniqueness and independence, we have to face the fact that we are who we are because of what has been fed into us, largely what has been fed to us, or at least in part. Part of our maturing into our own personhood includes taking ownership of parts of our identity. I am a person who values these things, and I am a person who behaves in this manner, and I own this. But we also recognize that we are products of our culture. We are products of our eras. We are products of our families and our neighborhoods, and dare I say it, our high school rivalries. Hopefully we let that go early on in our adulthood. But in stratified societies, that also means that we learn a lot about the people who are not like us in order to understand why they are not part of us. Part of our socialization often includes a narrative about how and why they are not like us, and therefore we should have separate experiences, separate lives. The writer of Ephesians is speaking into a context in which diverse people groups are coming together to become one people. We have Jews and Gentiles. Ephesians, of course, is not the only place in the biblical text that we read about the struggle between these two groups of people, these two distinct groups of people trying to figure out how to become one people, a people of God. And it makes sense that the long religious tradition of the Jews was so much invested in identity shaping, built around the covenant, "I will be your God and you will be my people." This then is how you should live. This is how you should treat one another. This is who you are, and this is who you are not. You are not like other nations. You are not to be warmongers. You are not to make riches for yourself. You are not to cheat one another. You are not like other nations. That message comes through over and over and over again. And so we have this one group that has been built up to understand very clearly who they are and who they are not. Here in Ephesians, however, the subject of the "you" of the letter is a Gentile audience who were aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, the text goes on to say. And while the writer doesn't get into very specific issues, the context is that main problem of the early church: how to live into this identity as one people from different traditions, and also how to be a subject of Rome and a subject of Christ at the same time, how to navigate those two worlds, and how to become an us. And the text talks about this before time and the now time and looks ahead to the future time. Before you knew Christ, but now, this is the future. You are moving forward as the church. And none of this writing is singular. It's plural. It is the plural you. It is the we. It is the us. It is about a people. It is not meant to be understood as this is your individual identity and you are figuring out how to do this. It is about us. Not for us also just to focus on our individual relationship with Jesus, but in a community, we are a people, and what does that mean? And so the concern, as the biblical text often leads us, is for the community, but then also outwardly for the world. As we just heard, the text talks about how we once lived, what our nature once was, like everyone else. We were once like everyone else, pursuing the ways of the world, headed for destruction. But in verse 4, there is this hinge, and it says, but because of God, you now have presence with Christ. And then the rest of the verses up to 10 point toward the future. It's future oriented. And I love the way that the Inclusive Bible stays true to the meaning of the word that is often translated into works or workmanship. We might be familiar with that from growing up. You are created for good works. You are God's workmanship. But the sense of that word in the Greek is about God's creative and even poetic work. And in this way, for me, it harkens back to the creation narrative in Genesis, that spilling out of this creative act of God. And when you read that text, you can almost revel in God just expanding creativity for something that holds powerful, powerful potential. That vision is there from the very beginning. And the writer of Ephesians reminds that community, that early community, and then also reminds us that we are part of that creative work for something. This is what I think grace is about, that we are God's artistic work. There's something about the urgency in this passage that makes me hear what I believe is the message in the backdrop and the thing that we know to be true from our own lives, that this work is not easy, folks. You've had a lifetime of conditioning, generations of teaching that have shown you that this is the way that you should be. And now, the text says, you have decided to cast your lot with these Jesus people. I don't think that the text is as simple as, well, okay, y'all used to be bad, and now you've decided to follow Jesus, and so now you need to be good. I think it's more complicated and actually more beautiful than that. I hear in this text, now you have the opportunity to live into the identity God chose for you since the beginning of the world. God had you in mind from the dawn of creation, and now you have come home. And you being away all that time, there's no penalty. You don't have to pay for that. By grace, you have been brought home, and now you are the people of God. And that verse 10, we are what God has made us, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand to be our way of life. That is to be our culture. That is to be our way of life. All of this, verses 1 through 10 in chapter 2, is the preamble to the passages that we'll look at next week about that dividing wall being broken down. We won't go there today, but we know that that's coming. That's the future orientation that these 10 verses are preparing us for. And this then is preparation for being a new kind of people, a new kind of community. A new kind of community that is bathed in grace. And because this section is pointing toward that unity and the demise of the dividing wall, I think it's worthwhile sitting in that image of being bathed in grace. Because this passage lingers on the possibilities of what can emerge from such a community. If God's people then and now are God's creative, poetic work, then what might God be calling this community to? Walls still exist. Literal dividing walls. Metaphorical tribal walls. Our existence as God's people does not pull us out of the realities of the world. Yes, God's people are called in. And I think that we know from our lived experience that this calling in is a day by day, moment by moment call to say yes over and over again. Yes to living into God's vision of an undivided people. A people, yes, but still wonderfully and beautifully diverse and holding themselves to the best of their ability to be unified in their identity as God's people. It is a call to offer each other and ourselves grace, and a call to hold ourselves and each other accountable. It is an invitation to question the ways in which our collective histories have taught us to divide ourselves. It is an invitation not to just a shallow diversity that looks good on a poster. You know, those posters with all the multicultural people and they're smiling and they're happy and it looks great. But it's deeper than that, because that poster probably doesn't get at the deep hurts and injustices perpetrated against people groups. It is walking in the way of Jesus, who stood with the marginalized and the maligned and called them, too, children of God. It is following the ways of Jesus, who stood up to the very moment of his death to empire. This isn't easy work. We know that. Families are complicated. Teams, I hear, are complicated. But it is our calling. We are God's poetic work, and we are called home. What then shall we do with such an invitation?